Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program.
Abby, we have a great show today.
We do. You know how last week you probably weren't listening because you were being tropical or something. But we talked about baby boomers. Well, today we have an actual baby boomer on the show with us. No, today we have Peter Simon on the radio show with us. And he has an amazing history of as a filmmaker and photojournalist, etc., documenting kind of the last 50 years, maybe more.
Well, yeah, over 40 years. He's had a
This is your 50th anniversary, right?
It is.
And thank you for having me on the air, by the way.
Well, it's nice to see you, Peter. And so you first started taking cameras, taking photographs when your father gave you a camera. How old were you?
Well, actually, it all started when I was about 8, because we would take walks together around our home north of New York City called Riverdale, a little suburb of the Bronx, and a very nice neighborhood. My father founded Simon & Schuster, the publishing company, so we had, you know, I was given a kind of an upper-middle-class lifestyle, which I didn't appreciate at the time because I didn't know any different. But anyway, that's another story. We would take walks together, and he'd always be fiddling with this device, and I finally wanted to know what it was, and he said, "It's a camera, son." And he also played the piano besides being a fantastic and visionary publisher. But he's also a passionate photographer. So he showed me how to use his camera, and we took a roll of film, and we went into his darkroom, and he developed it, and I saw all these negatives. And I said, "You know, Dad, why is it all, like, reversed?" And he said, "Oh, it's a negative, you nut." So I said, "Okay, what's that?" And he explained that, and then it was dried, and he put the negative into the enlarger and focused it on a piece of undeveloped paper. And I saw the print actually develop in the chemistry in the darkroom for the first time when I was about 9. And I went, "Wow, Dad, you're a genius." And he said, "Well, I'm sort of an amateur, but I know what I'm doing." So I just followed in his footsteps, and he died when I was only 12.
Right, he died you were at a very young age. And so tell me, as a young photographer, what was one of your favorite early subject matters?
Well, I watched him photograph my family more than anything. Mm-hmm. So after he died, a sad death, he was a cigarette smoker, 3 packs a day type of guy.
Ouch.
And under a lot of pressure at work. And he just died a very miserable death, and it was sad for me to see. This fallen man who had been such a pioneer. But at any rate, I saw him photograph our family while growing up, and I saw mostly pictures of my sisters and my mother. So I thought, well, I got to keep on the path of documenting our family. So that's what I did. Long before she was well known, I took pictures of Carly Simon, who happens to be one of my 3 sisters. So I've got all these teeny bopper pictures of her still in the archives, and all my family members. And so that was basically what I did to begin with. The other piece of this is that at school, I was never a good student. We're talking about high school now. I was kind of ugly and gawky looking and not athletic, and people made fun of me a lot. I was bullied. And the thing that got me through my high school years was the fact that I had a camera, and I would take pictures of these classmates and go home and develop them and print them and bring them the next day. And all the classmates would go, "Wow, you can do that?" And suddenly I had self-esteem and recognition. So that was what propelled me. I started working for a local paper in Riverdale, and at my school, people like Martin Luther King would lecture, and I took pictures of the day Kennedy was killed. I became a photojournalist at a really young age, is what I'm trying to say, and it got me enough recognition, despite poor grades, to get me into Boston University in 1965. And that's when the boomers really started taking off.
That's right.
So those are my introductory remarks.
Well, I mean, I think this brings up the what is so amazing about what you were able to take pictures of is like you had a camera at all these amazing times. I mean, if you look at you have a bunch of people looking at or getting the news that JFK was shot. And that's kind of and just you can see the pain in people's faces and it's and on. It keeps going and going and going. Riverdale, my family's from Riverdale.
Really? Yeah. I never knew that.
I didn't know that about you. Yeah, I spent my early years around there. And then what happened to you is you also happened to be there. 1965, Boston, you know, it was like the hotbed of protests and you know, experimentation and drugs and sex and rock and roll. And you took pictures of all of that. And that's just, I mean, so that's what was kind of amazing about it. Kind of what happened to you at BU, what were some of the kind of amazing things that you got to experience and share with people through your pictures?
Well, very early on, I became photo editor of the BU News, which at the time was the first student-run radical newspaper. It took all these stands against the war in Vietnam and stands against pro-choice and in the environment. And we had like a really left-wing group of students that took over the paper. The administration was not too pleased, but it was the catalyst for my photography at the time of going to all these peace demonstrations at Boston Common. Howard Zinn was my professor. And then obviously marijuana sort of seeped right in there about the, you know, 66, 67 when the yep. Beatles showed us the way. We were all there. So we were all smoking all the time. I think the second half of my college career, I was stoned about three quarters of the time. It didn't seem to affect my grades, and it made me enjoy my life a lot more at the time.
But there you were, in a generation of substance use, free love, right? And you had an opportunity to, well, I mean, isn't it true? If you're there, I mean, it's kind of where you are. If you're there, you get that opportunity, and you photographed the first Woodstock.
Actually, I took a poster of the first Woodstock. I was going to go to Woodstock. I had my press pass. I was by that time shooting for Rolling Stone, and they wanted me to go and photograph it. Mm-hmm. And I got stuck on Martha's Vineyard, which is where I was living
That's
and still
right.
do.
That's right.
I couldn't get off the island to get to Woodstock.
So you smoked pot during this era. Lots of people were trying a lot of other things. And did you?
I was always afraid of anything harder than pot, and I have to say I did some acid, but I was, once again, I was always too much of a hypochondriac to really push the envelope and try a full dose of acid. And I stayed away from cocaine and heroin and alcohol. I was like, had nothing to do with it. It was considered like the straight thing that Republicans did, and if you were a freak and you were like into the movement and wanted peace, love, and harmony, you didn't go near alcohol, which I didn't. I mean, I never had any desire for it whatsoever, and pot was my drug of choice, and I believed in it and smoked it at least up until the year 2000, really. Mm-hmm. Although I backed off on it because I finally had to get serious and start making money and raise a family and be responsible. So it became less of a focal point and more of just a little social type of thing. But I still, of all the drugs, and I'm sure you've said this on the air, Woody, it's the least harmful of the substances out there, I think.
I don't know what we think. We've been dabbling with this idea because I think the people's perceived lack of danger is one of the things that worries me. Yeah. So the other thing I really... So then you did what everybody did, was establish a commune. I mean, moved on to a commune. I mean, not everybody, but it was symbolically everybody did. And before we go to break, do you want to just tell us how photography fit in with that?
Sure. It was the late 60s, and Boston was the hotbed. It was the San Francisco of the East Coast. And, you know, groups, Grateful Dead were coming through, The Byrds, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan. I mean, it was such an amazing time. And I got to photograph everyone but Hendrix. And the reason I didn't get Hendrix was because I got the assignment to photograph him from Rolling Stone. my girlfriend and I took a little bit of acid just to get into the mood of the thing, but it was stronger than I thought. And as I was driving to Boston Garden to see Jimi Hendrix and photograph him, suddenly I had this wave of like fear and paranoia, and suddenly I thought I was on the West Side Highway in New York rather than in Boston. And so I got really disoriented. And I said to my girlfriend, you know, I don't think I can handle like a big rock scene with getting backstage. And I mean, I'm just too frazzled. And she said, all right, let's just go home and, you know, like trip it home.
Yeah.
So little did I know that this would be my only chance to photograph him.
We're talking to Peter Simon. This is Right Turn Radio. We're going to come back more about Peter Simon and his years of photography and photojournalism. We'll be right back. You know, Peter, I was once walking into a golf club on Martha's Vineyard, and there was a beautiful photograph of John Updike shot by you in your, obviously in your early days of pioneering your photography. But then, you know, much later on, there was Jimi Hendrix, there was the Rolling Stones, there was your trips to Jamaica living with the Peter Tosh and Bob Marley and Bob Dylan. So now we're into a whole different area where people are thinking much differently.
Yeah, I was going to say that after being in Boston in the late 60s, there was the political movement that I became so attached to became much more radical, and there was a sense of fighting for peace, and I was always give peace a chance type of guy, and fun-loving and communal and group hugs and be-ins and love-ins and trip-ins, and so I kind of tripped out of the Boston scene around 1970 and moved to a commune in southern Vermont, and it was called Tree Frog Farm, and it was about 15 of us. We all became very good friends while students at BU, and we spent 2 years trying to like experience what it's like to raise our own vegetables, milk our own cows, grow our own vegetables, you know, do even grow our own pot. I mean, everything was self-sustaining. And that was a very interesting era for me. And it continued along my desire to photograph the alternative culture from A to Z. And then occasionally I'd leave the commune and go see the Band in Boston or the Grateful Dead. I became a huge Deadhead and followed them around the country for a couple of years in there. And then reggae really caught me. I saw the movie The Harder They Come many, many times at the Orson Welles Cinema in Cambridge. And I just became hooked. I mean, here is a hippie, a slightly radical hippie, suddenly becoming a reggae nut and going down and doing books about reggae. So that's where I shifted away from rock and roll a little bit to reggae.
And did you continue to smoke pot all during? I mean, this is also your story about your addiction and your redemption.
This is true. We'll get to that.
So you continue
because I had a pretty bad fall there for a while, but way before that happened, I did. I smoked weed as though it were a sacrament, and I loved it. I don't think I was one of those people that was stoned all day long. And when I went to Jamaica, it was so much more powerful. And there were Rastas sitting on stoops on benches or porches, just smoking one joint after the next, after the next, after the next. And that always seemed a little excessive to me. And I could see how these lives were just sort of, they were kind of a depressed lifestyle because it was so poor. You know, it's a third world country. Mm-hmm. And I could see that the only way out was to be so stoned that you didn't care.
Right.
And but I was never quite, you know, these spliffs that they had down there were like huge. And one day Bob Marley actually offered me a puff from his own spliff, which was a show of great respect, actually, because they don't do that in Jamaica, generally speaking. So I got to hang out with all the Rastas and Marley and Peter Tosh, as you say, and I photographed them and did three subsequent books about reggae. So, yeah, that was an extension of my wanting to photograph the alternative spirit and culture.
Well, and what was happening back here about, I mean, did people, I mean, back in this country, were people becoming more accepting of it, or were drugs changing? Because you're not a lot older than me, but the whole idea of, like, new drugs came in, and you didn't join in on those.
Well, cocaine took over in the late 70s. I mean, a lot of my good friends got addicted to it, and it frightened me because I could see how agitated and mean, and it became kind of a mean drug. And a lot of people's personalities changed. And I thought, I don't want to do that. I mean, I was kind of, it's strange, but I saw marijuana as much more of a pure high without a demonic side. I mean, maybe it made me slightly dysfunctional, and maybe I would have been a rich and famous publisher like my father was if I hadn't turned the hippie route. But I loved every minute of it. I mean, I was gaining so much, gaining so many images for my collection. Plus, I was just living life to the fullest, and it was a very exciting time to be alive. And now, as us baby boomers slowly die off, I realize how special that time period was, and it will never be the same.
Well, so here you are now in the 70s, and there's the Grateful Dead and Led Zeppelin and other people that have been the topic of or subject of your photography. And so now you're in the middle of a pretty heavy drug scene, would you say?
I would. When I toured with the Dead, it was... You know, pot was once again the main drug, but Jerry got very addicted to, well, he's a big cigarette smoker, but also opium and heroin eventually. And, you know, to see that guy go down in the mid-90s was terrible for me. I just, here's the death of one of my idols. And I was good friends with Garcia because he always loved my photography and he loved the fact that I didn't pose people and I was just kind of a fly on the wall type of photojournalist, which is what I did
right. The
best. And so we would get stoned together, but there's always a cigarette involved too, and that bothered me because I never smoked because my father was an addict and he died of that. And I just wound up hating that smell, so I kept away from anybody doing tobacco. I was really a purist in the sense that it was pot or basically nothing.
Well, and but you really got to watch people fall around you. Which,
I did.
Yeah, that's tragic.
It was. But then the cocaine drain, as I say, the late 70s, early 80s, it really affected the lives of a lot of my friends. I didn't like the way, you know, they'd yell and scream and be very paranoid, and I wasn't used to that. So I just put the brakes on with that.
So you're an artist, and you're surrounded by this whole drug culture, and you're saying that the substance use didn't really interfere with your ability to produce as an artist, but you were seeing not only friends and family members, but a huge part of the drug culture going on around you. Was it hard for you to see all of these people fall?
Yeah, it was, actually, Woody. It scared me. And I didn't want to be any part of it. And I started removing myself a little bit from it by the 80s. I wasn't getting stoned as much as I said because I was starting to raise a family and
right.
I had to make some money and, you know, the hippie days were sort of fading away and a lot of people were on to big careers and making a lot of money and I felt this kind of pressure now to, all right, let's get on with it. Especially when I had my son who is now 27, so that kind of rates him around 1986.
Right.
and all the way through the 90s, you know, I never really did. I started letting up on the marijuana. I didn't like it so much anymore. I had some paranoia issues that would happen and some anxiety from it. So I kind of got straight for a while. And then all hell broke loose. And if you want to save that for the next segment, we can. It's up to you.
Well, I mean, I think the one thing that, I mean, people, if you look at Peter's work, you see photographs, somebody called him the Forrest Gump of, and even though it makes him sound like not as important, but he was there. I mean, there's pictures of RFK, there's photographs of, oh yeah, I mean, you know, when Martin Luther King came to my school, you know, I mean, it's just amazing who he was able to see and document, you know, he might have missed Jimi Hendrix, but he got, you know, a lot of people who, you know, were huge icons of the time and were taking the culture in it originally, I think, in a direction where it felt really, really upbeat and then turned really, really started getting scary and sour.
Yeah, it is. It's an eclectic range of photography. And you now are releasing this on a 2 DVD set. And maybe now with just a minute left, we maybe maybe we can give away one of those, Peter. What do you think?
Okay. I know we're up against the break, but I have put out a DVD called Through the Lens, celebrating 50 years of personalized photojournalism. I'm very proud of this, and there's a whole chapter on it about addiction and recovery, because that is a big part of my story, which we haven't even gotten to. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to give one out, and for free. Normally it's $24.95, and you can order it at petersimon.com. It's a very instructive and thorough examination of our lives as boomers. But I will give one out for free if you can call us at the station and answer the following question. My motto in the mid to late 60s was tune in, turn on, and drop out. Which is what we did as a group of hippies flowering in the late 60s. If you know who made that statement famous, give us a call. And if you're right with the answer, I'll give you the DVD.
So we're going to go away to a break. We'll be right back with, we have the phone lines just lit up, Peter.
Okay,
we'll
good.
Be right back All with right. Right Turn Radio. Let's go to Lee. Lee, do you have the answer to Peter's question today?
I don't know if I have the answer or not. I'm just going to take a guess. Timothy Leary.
You got
Excellent.
It.
Excellent.
Excellent.
You've
won. Where's the bell? Ding, 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 ding.
I just read a book about him. I don't know if you know about it. He was in Newton, you know, and it described the whole scene with him. Very interesting.
Oh, yeah. And at Harvard College, too, and all
yes.
those fun things. So if you stay on the line, our engineer will get your information.
Let's go to Julie. Julie, you're live on the air with Peter Simon. Do you have the answer to the question?
Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary, yeah. Hard
That's right,
yeah.
It's like cats out of the bag.
Cats out of the bag, huh?
Oh, I knew that.
They already got screened.
Question.
Hi, Julie.
Hi, thanks, Julie, for calling.
I recognize this voice.
Yes, you do.
Hi, Julie. It's lovely to hear your voice.
Hi, everybody.
So do you know anything about aging baby boomers that you want to share with us?
I am an aging yes. baby boomer.
Welcome to the club.
Yes. So we'll get your information, and we will mail you one of the DVDs, and they're really cool.
But if you have a question to ask me, feel free.
Do you have any
free.
Questions for Peter?
Not really, no.
That's
no,
all right.
Not at this time, no.
Thank you, Julie.
Julie, thank you
we'll
so
get
much.
You the DVD.
So I mean, here you are, and you've alluded to the fact that, you know, you're carrying along your wonderful life, and, you know, you have a kid, and, you know, or maybe kids by this point.
Just one, actually.
A kid, you're living on the vineyard. Things are blissful and wonderful. But at some point, you got in trouble.
I did. And that's probably why I'm here today, other than to promote my DVD. But
no, it's because we like you, Peter.
Oh, thanks. Well, I love you guys, too. And I love what you're doing with this show. Okay, so here's what happened. I decided to publish a book about I've had published 10 books already. But I decided it was time to do a really comprehensive...
The opus.
Yep. And it was called, or it still is called, I and I, Pictures of My Generation. And I spent about 3 years with this book. And it was published by Little Brown. And the pub date was 9/11/01.
Ouch.
And there was a lot of anticipation about this book. And, you know, they... spent a lot of money to publish it beautifully. And here I am with a brand new book ready to go out and be interviewed on radio and television to support it. And I was on my way to Boston, and I was going to be on the air on, I don't remember which station, it was maybe television, whatever. I had a whole series of interviews. And I came up to Boston to be on the air. And I got to, I said, can you tell me how to get to the station? And they said, Mr. Simon, your interview's been canceled today. I said, really? What's going on? Why? Why would you not want me? And they said, well, turn on the radio and you'll find out. Click. So I got a really sickening feeling in my stomach and turned on the radio and found out what had happened in New York and the Twin Towers. And I thought, oh my God, this is a horrible thing, but it's also going to affect this book because I'm never going to be able to promote it. No one will care about it. And, you know, what a horrible twist of fate. So basically the book tanked, and I went into a very deep depression because I felt that everything that I'd lived for, this manifestation of our culture, was being severely affected by the terrorists. And I got very depressed for the whole country and the world. And I started drinking alcohol out of the blue, more or less. because I found it was the only thing that made me feel numb to what was going on. And I medicated myself. And I'd been used to years of using pot sort of to self-medicate, but more of an expansive drug. Alcohol just numbed me. But I used it very much like pot, which was the first thing in the morning. Hey, where's that vodka? I'm going to just do a couple hits just to get through the next 3 hours. And I gradually built up to that. I'm not saying it happened to Abby right at the beginning, but you know, within the first year after 2001, I was a 24/7 alcoholic.
Wow.
And really had a very quick decline, both physically, mentally, and spiritually. And because I would drive all the time stoned, and never thought much of it, I would just drink and drive as though, hey, I can handle this.
And so you're living on the vineyard.
Yeah.
And you're, you know, it's a small, it's an island, but it's a small community of artists. Were your friends concerned about you?
And, you know, I was pretty secretive about it. I would hide my drinking. Mm-hmm. I was a closet alcoholic. But they, my family and friends became very concerned as the DUIs started to pile up. I had three in the space of 4 years.
Wow.
And finally, you know, it really, the crap hit the fan. By 2004, I was waking up in the morning with the dry heaves and, you know, it was late. And when I did a wedding, I did a lot of wedding photography back then on the vineyard. I remember I see the bar and I would just go over there and drink. And by the time it was time to cut the cake, I was like out cold on the floor. And it was very embarrassing. And word got out that you can't hire Simon anymore because he's going to drink. So my whole career hit the skids and my health did. And I lost it. Eventually wound up in jail on the vineyard for 45 days and was told that you are either in here for 2 years or you get help. And thank God I did. I went to Renaissance Institute in Florida and got the 6 months that I needed.
So you spent 6 months. You spent 6 months in treatment.
Correct.
That's what a wonderful thing to be able to have 6 months.
So you're alcoholic. You were drinking alcoholically for the better part of a year.
No, it was more like four years.
More like 4 years. Yeah. Okay. And so this is the first time that substance use had kind of interfered with your ability to be the artist that you are.
Yeah, because I kept thinking that alcohol and pot were kind of the same. I don't know what made me think that, but they aren't. And, you know, alcohol just grabbed me by the throat because I became physically addicted to it. And I would, you know, going through the withdrawal of not drinking was so scary for me that I would just drink to ward off the symptoms of withdrawal. It was really horrible. I mean, those 4 years were... I wouldn't be alive now if I didn't go to rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly couldn't have put out this DVD, which is a culmination of 50 years. And there's one chapter in it about this whole experience and my photographing drug addicts and, you know, the whole way that alcohol has taken over our culture, even at my age. Us boomers are much more alcoholics than we are pot smokers at this point.
So talk about how it's changed. Talk about that chapter, because I thought that chapter was really neat.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I can statistically say this is true, but I think it seems to me as though most of my good friends from that era know if they want to do anything, they're going to drink.
Right.
And drinking is very accepted. It was very accepted, you know, as a social thing. The trouble is that I was born with an addictive gene, I'm sure, and it just grabbed me. And I still see my friends just drinking away like there's no tomorrow, and it doesn't really get to them the way it did to me for the most part. But I'm very active. I go to meetings, and I love to help people. And on the vineyard, it is a small community, and everyone knows my story because I tell it, you know, oftentimes. But I tell it because I want to help people and have them avoid what happened to me. Because
right.
I think it's important. And so the DVD, it's not a big part of the DVD. It's only one chapter out of 12, but it's important. It's an important part of my story. And here I am resurrected. You know, I'm not getting any younger, by the way. I'm 67. And, you know, my knees are bothering me. I'm not able to climb backstage the way I used to in my youth. But I still feel I want to document what's going on around me and try to make some money and spread the word that, you know, there is life after death with alcohol.
So what are you documenting now? And then we're going to go back to like the recovery talk. So what do you, you know, so you got sober and then all of a sudden you decided it wasn't over. What did you do?
Well, I was in rehab for 6 months in Florida.
No camera?
They would not let me. When I first got there, they took everything away from me. My computer, my camera, my phone, everything, because they wanted me to go back to square one. And it was really hard. But I needed it. You know, I was very entitled. I thought I was special. I thought I was different. I mean, that's what most alcoholics are. They think, you know, the world revolves around us wanting to get drunk. And that's all that counts. And so I needed to be just as humble as I could be. And as soon as I got away from the main treatment, I had to get a recovery job. So what did I do? I worked at the equivalent of a McDonald's hamburger place.
Ooh.
And sat people and, you know, said, you can sit here if you want the view of the street, or you can sit here. And I was a host at a hamburger place for 2 months, earning $10 an hour. But I just thought that's what I had to do. I mean, I just had to get as humble. And some people came in who were customers of mine from the Vineyard. They said, what are you doing this in Delray Beach, Florida? And I had to say, you know, I've really hit a wall, and I'm trying to get my life back together, and this is the way that I'm doing it. And I was very open about it. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not.
No, I mean, I think that's one of the nicest things about this, is that you're really out about your recovery. And so do you still, you're still active in recovery and meetings and all that stuff?
I go to a lot of meetings. I find, especially in the winter, if I were to relapse at all, I mean, you probably read this in the New York Times the other day, that people on heroin in Vermont now, the winter's so horribly cold that the only thing they want to do, kids, young kids, 20, 21, is shoot up, because it's so depressing. And I think, you know, living in the northern hemisphere here, it is pretty depressing.
Has been a heck of a winter.
And the Vineyard is full of alcoholism. It really is. And a lot of people come in and out of meetings, and you hear of relapse and people dying. And I mean, it's heavy duty. But I'm very tuned into the community. And well, on a snowy night in January, I'm not going to just stay at home and want to drink. I want to go out and be with people who are suffering from my disease.
Yeah, so we're going to go away. We're going to have another break. Peter, this is Peter Simon, photographer. He's been our guest on the show today. Would you like to go ahead and give away one more of your DVDs before we go away?
Actually, let's go away, and I have to think of a question and then come
back.
Well,
I have a question.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Peter, you have a very famous brother-in-law.
I do.
And you shot a photograph for the cover of his album.
Okay, that's true.
Should we put that out there?
What's the name of the guy, or what's the name of the album?
Either one. Come up with the answer. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. I'm Woody Geisman. I'm here with Abby Dean, and our guest today is photographer Peter Simon. We'll be right back.
My sister had that album.
I remember it being covered by Stems and Seeds, but
yes,
I did have that album, yes.
So, I mean, I think the one thing we come across after all this is that you have been in a lot of situations where you were the most sober person in a non-sober, fairly celebrity-ish world. How do you maintain that today?
Well, it is a little difficult because I live in a swinging world, I guess to use an old phrase, of people that really do like to either get stoned, although not so many anymore of us, and who drink. I go to a lot of cocktail parties, a lot of fundraisers, and people offer me liquor at these things. Some people don't know that I have to say no. And it is hard at times, Abby. It's a challenge. But the thing that keeps me from picking up and using is the memories of what it did to me. And I mentioned to a little story that I mentioned to you earlier, I could say again, and that is I was on the beach taking a family portrait last Labor Day weekend, and I was complaining I was really thirsty, because I was. And they said, oh, come over to our blanket. We're watching the sunset, and we have beverages over at the blanket. I went, great. So I went over to the blanket with them after the photos were done, and they handed me a glass, and they said, it's iced tea. So I thought, okay, great. So I drank the iced tea. I was so thirsty, I gulped the whole thing down. And then I realized, oh, there's a taste in here that I remember from my past.
Ouch.
And I said, did you, is there anything in this? And he said, oh yeah, we put some vodka in there. We thought you'd enjoy it. And I didn't make a big stink about it. I didn't want to say, oh, well, I'm a recovering alcoholic. How could you do this to me? So I just drank it. I said, or it was already finished. And I got very scared by that because I didn't like the smell. And then I was also driving. I finally got my license back after 8 years. And I thought, I better get home fast before my blood level goes up. And so I just drove right home. And so it was fortunately about 5 minutes away. When I got home, I started feeling the effects of the vodka. And I thought to myself, this feels horrible. I hate this feeling. I don't want to feel this ever again.
That's good.
And so I said to myself, is this the high that you were chasing so viciously for 5 years? I really, it was a big turning point for me because I just knew that I didn't want to touch this anymore. And that's how but it is hard to say, no, I don't drink. I mean, it puts me in the spotlight to a degree. But hey, it's part of my life that I'm just not going to have anymore.
You know, Elton John has a person who follows him around and is a private taster. So in case they're in a restaurant, before he is served a drink, someone will
taste
it for him.
I need a taster.
That's what you need, Peter. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Paul. Paul, you're live on the air with Peter Simon. Do you have an answer to our question?
I do. I want to say James Taylor.
You are right. What's the name of the album?
Kind of an easy one.
That's right. Do you know the name of the album?
Oh, I didn't hear that part of the question.
No, we were just quizzing you.
Oh.
it's this great shot of a dog, of him standing in a boat with a dog on it. And
it sounds marvelous.
It is marvelous. So stay on.
And your show is great, too, and it's encouraging to people, and it's a nice show.
Do you want to ask anything of Peter?
No, I just want to wish you good luck, man. You're doing something great. I really applaud what you've done.
Well, thanks for calling, and if you stay on the line, we'll get you your DVD celebrating my 50 years of photojournalism.
Yeah. Paul, thank you so much. And so let's talk a little bit about some of your events coming up here. You're in town.
I'm in town just for the night, and then I'm going back to the vineyard tomorrow. And then if we don't have a big storm on Thursday.
It's going to rain. No more snow. We're done.
Good. On Thursday night, there's a honoring night. I'm going to be given a night to honor my DVD and my life at a place in Chilmark called Pathways, which is right in the middle of town. And it starts at 6 o'clock and goes to 10. And I'm going to be showing parts of the DVD and talking. And then my wonderful niece, Sally Taylor, is going to sing along with Sister Kate Taylor. And it's going to be like a real way to celebrate my life locally on the vineyard. And then in April, on April 10th, a similar scene will unfold at the Calumet Photography Store, 150 First Street in Cambridge. And we'll have food and pizza and music and images. So mark that down on your Peter Simon calendar if you have one. And hey, it's been great. I really love being here.
I have one more question. You talk about family like as being important to your sobriety. How did they handle your, you know, all your DUIs and your depression and your drinking, and how do they handle it now? I mean, where's family?
Well, I have to thank Carly for getting me into rehab. She found the one in Florida, which was the final one. I had been to two other ones and failed, and Carly did her homework.
I think that's important to say. That it's not always the first try people get this, and it's just great that you got it.
Well, the other ones were too short, only 28 days. I don't think that's enough time.
It's not enough.
And this one was 6 months, and I have to thank Carly for that. She used her, you know, she used all her connections to get me into this place called Renaissance Institute in Florida that were for frequent relapsers. And so they all were very concerned. They all came and visited me in jail one day. And my oldest sister was so upset that she had to leave the jail and go out and vomit. I mean, it was that visceral for her. And, you know, they were pulling for me, but they were very worried, very, you know. Alcohol didn't really run in our family. It was sort of, I was the odd duck in that department. But they pulled me through, and now they're all you know, now they treat me back to being a normal person again. So it doesn't come up anymore that much. But for the first couple of years, I was quizzed all the time by my sisters. Thank God my mother died before this all happened. She would have just hated to see me drunken.
Yeah, this is not where somebody wants to see their boy.
And then my son, Willie and Ronnie, you know, I put my son through a lot of embarrassment when he was a high schooler because he would have kids over all the time and I would like be slobbering around, and he finally stopped having friends over at the house, and then his first year in college I was in jail and rehab, so he's forgiven me, he's gotten over it, and now I'm treated kind of like a normal person again. And my wife stuck, here's one thing I want to hand it to Ronnie, she stuck with me, and that's hard.
Yeah,
4 years of a drunken husband who just was crazed and mean, and you know, I talked about cocaine being a mean drug. Alcohol is just as mean.
Oh, yeah.
And but she's a very loyal person, and now we're happily reunited.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you, and I thank you for coming, and I love that you get the word out that recovery works, and that, you know, and there's, you know, and as part of this generation, it's going to be tough for people aging, and I hope you keep documenting.
Well, I don't want to lose my mind. I mean, this cognitive decline is bad enough. Why speed it up?
That's right.
But it's also wonderful to hear, you know, an artist who got clean and sober and picked up his your camera in this case again. And it's a wonderful thing. You know who you are. You know what your passion is. You got clean and sober, and you're continuing to follow your passion.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.